Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Mark Twain, who lived from 1835 to 1910, was the author of many famous books, including the classics Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. Many would say that Mark Twain was the greatest writer that America ever produced. In today's edition of History Counts, we're going to examine a very important aspect of Mark Twain's remarkable career, his influential role as a passionate opponent of nascent American imperialism. Mark Twain felt very strongly that the United States at the turn of the century was headed in a tragically wrong direction, as it sought to emulate the great powers of Europe by establishing its own global empire. Twain's work against American imperialism figured very prominently in the final years of his career, when he was at the peak of his renown, in America and abroad. As a result, Mark Twain came to be regarded as the leading anti-imperialist of his time. While over the years, Twain's work and writings opposing imperialism have been largely ignored and sometimes suppressed, they appear as relevant today as they were a century ago. So we're pleased to bring you this month's edition of History Counts, Mark Twain versus the Imperialists. Welcome back to History Counts. In this series, we've had the good fortune to have many distinguished and learned guests, but none more distinguished or learned than the gentleman who is our guest today. Although raised in small-town America, our guest has traveled to all the great cities both in the United States and abroad. In his varied career, he has worked in printing, shipping, mining, and journalism. He's widely known to audiences around the world for his edifying and entertaining lectures, but he's best known for his works of fiction, which have placed him in the first ranks of American writers. So we're very pleased to welcome to History Counts today, Mr. Mark Twain.
Thank you, Mr. McDermott Rowe, for your most gracious introduction. It is a pleasure to be here. Do you mind if I smoke?
Oh, no, go ahead. You're, of course, best known to our audience as the author of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Both are regarded as classics, and many critics say that Huckleberry Finn was the first great American novel.
I was very fortunate to have the acquaintance of Huck and Tom. We had a lot of fun together, and along the way, the boys gave me the chance to make a serious point every now and then.
If you don't mind, I'd like to talk to you today about a very serious side of your writing career. In October 1900, on your return from a long European trip, you told the awaiting reporters, quote, "I am an anti-imperialist. I am opposed to having the eagle put its talons on any other land." What prompted you to make such a statement?
I was disgusted with the treaty that ended the Spanish-American War.
Why?
Let me back up a little. As you know, our wise and generous leaders looked around the world in 1898 and noticed that our great country lacked one important accoutrement, an empire. Why our cousins the British had an empire, the French had an empire, even the Russians had an empire. So why not the land of the free and the brave? So these leaders studied the world situation carefully and determined that the weakest player on the empire team was Spain. Well, 1, 2, 3, we knocked Spain down and picked up all its marbles. The marbles in this case being the Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam.
But didn't you originally support the war against Spain?
At first, I did. Like a lot of other Americans, I took President McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt, and the other trailblazers at their word. The war, they said, was a crusade to free subjugated wretches from the cruel yoke of Spanish tyranny. In the Philippines, I thought we were going to put a miniature of the American Constitution afloat in the Pacific. It turned out that we Americans were played for fools. So were the Filipinos and the others. In the so-called treaty that ended the Spanish-American War, we bought, I say bought, the Philippines from Spain for $20 million.
We bought the Philippines?
That's right, $20 million. came out to about $2 a head. A nice price by any measure.
Now, what right did we have to do that?
The right of the gun. Of course, we told them it was for their own good. We were going to bring these ignorant, benighted people the blessings of American civilization. So we ordered the Filipinos' new Republican government to take a permanent holiday. New management. The USA was taking over.
How did we get in charge?
Treachery and deceit. Your listeners will recall how Admiral Dewey made short work of the Spanish Navy during the opening scene of the war in May 1898. Well, the real heavy lifting was done by Filipino patriots on the ground. By August, the Filipinos, under their leader Aguinaldo, had liberated just about the whole country from the Spanish. They declared Philippine independence and surrounded the Spanish garrison at Manila. Now the USA says, "Hold on, boys, you're getting a bit ahead of yourselves. We forbade the Filipino army from entering their own capital while we took over from the Spanish. Then we started setting up U.S.-controlled areas all over their country and put up Do Not Enter signs."
So what did the Filipinos do?
In February 1899, we shot a Filipino crossing into so-called American territory, and before you know it, a full-blown guerrilla war broke out. And it was nasty.
Nasty?
Oh, yes. We certainly brought them the blessings of civilization. General Jacob Smith, one of our great heroes of the war, gave these instructions to his Marine commander. "I want no prisoners. I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and burn, the better it will please me." So the Marine officer asked General Smith, "I would like to know the limit of age to respect, sir." 10 years old, the good general replied.
Those were U.S. soldiers?
Yes, I'm sorry to say. One of these young American soldiers actually wrote a letter home about his military exploits, which ended up getting published in a paper in Iowa. He said, "We never left one alive. If he was wounded, we would run our bayonets through him." We brought them other blessings, too. Did I mention the concentration camps and the water cure?
The water cure?
One of our most imaginative blessings. You force some wretch's mouth open and pour gallons of water down his throat. Stomach swells. Can't breathe. That's when the real business commences. A soldier jumps on the subject's stomach until he either sees the light of civilization or perishes. Even did that one on a priest.
A Catholic priest?
A fellow by the name of Father Augustine. Seems that Father Augustine had the temerity to raise money to support the Philippine soldiers. I mean the ungrateful peasants who refused the blessings of civilization. So Father Augustine was treated to a medicinal dose of the water cure. We became experts in the fine art of torture.
Why did the United States want the Philippines so much?
China.
China?
You bet. Our business leaders and their government friends were pulling at the bit to get a piece of the fabled Chinese market. Why, the Europeans were all over China, the Japanese too. But we needed a place where our trading ships and warships could stop for coal and other refreshments on the way to the promised land. The Philippines fit the bill just perfectly.
So it was about money.
Now you're getting it, young man. Extending the blessings of civilization to our ignorant brothers who sit in the darkness is good trade. It pays well, though I'm sure never enough.
What happened to the Filipino leader, Aguinaldo?
Oh, we played a neat trick on our good friend Aguinaldo.
What was that?
One of our most brilliant generals by the name of Funston devised a plan to capture our friend through deceit. Funston forged a letter pretending to be a Filipino officer in order to gain access to Aguinaldo's headquarters. He and his boys entered the camp with a bunch of local mercenaries disguised as Filipino soldiers. They treacherously shot Aguinaldo's welcoming committee and took him prisoner. It was all over before our good friend knew what hit him.
How long did the American war against the Filipinos last?
Well, we declared victory in 1902, but the locals didn't take much notice and they kept fighting us for years, especially the Filipino Muslims down in the south.
Muslims?
Yes, Muslims. They were particularly ungrateful and resisted the blessings of civilization to the very end. Fortunately, we had brave generals like the good Dr. Leonard Wood to help them see the error of their ways.
Dr. Wood?
Leonard Wood was a doctor, but this healer soon learned there was a lot more fun and glory in the martial arts than the healing arts. He was hero of the famous Battle of Mount Dajo in March of 1906.
Please, tell us the story.
The so-called Battle of Mount Dajo is in the history books. A bunch of these Filipino Muslims called Moros, who took exception to the American occupation of their country, took refuge in the crater of a volcano. It appears there were close to 1,000 of them, including many women and children. Word of the Moro encampment at Mount Dajo reached General Leonard Wood. This very astute general immediately recognized the situation as an excellent opportunity for manly combat. However, he did not immediately order an assault. No, this was a formidable opponent. So General Wood sought the help of the United States Navy. The Navy obliged with an artillery bombardment from gunboats that rained shells down on the Muslims. The official American report of the battle states that women and children were, quote, unavoidably killed by the shelling. Fortunately, General Wood had sufficiently recovered from his training as a lifesaver to inure himself to their suffering. Now General Wood was ready for his part in this great contest. He ordered his men up the hill in three columns, lest any of the poor wretches escape. The Moros did not comprehend the hopelessness of their position. They resisted the American army fiercely. Some were actually armed. Yes, armed. You see, they had the latest technology. Spears and a handy device they called a kris, a kind of sword. Impressive though these weapons may be, they proved to be no match for rifles, Gatling guns, and artillery. Despite the sniper fire and artillery shells, the Moros left their crater refuge and sallied forth. They never reached the American lines. They were cut down to a man. Then the closing act of the drama commenced. The American troops breached the Moro defenses at the rim of the crater. "Fix bayonets," ordered General Wood, and down the crater they charged. When the smoke cleared, Moro dead were piled five deep. Many of them had as many as 51 wounds each. Some claimed that all the enemy were exterminated, but others allowed that as many as 6 of them survived.
How did the U.S. government react?
The commander-in-chief, that's President Teddy Roosevelt, you know, the rough-riding hero of the Cuban War, wasted no time in sending his warmest wishes to his old friend, the brave General Wood. The president's words were so eloquent, so inspirational, that I carry a copy of his telegram with me at all times. Where is it? Oh, here it is. Washington, D.C., March 10th, 1906. To General Leonard Wood. I congratulate you upon the brilliant feat of arms wherein you have so well upheld the honor of the American flag.
What did you think of that?
The president probably understated the case. You see, some untutored individuals might have viewed the so-called Battle of Mount Dajo as the butchery of innocent civilians by an invading army, a blight upon the honor of the United States. But a truly insightful and morally advanced leader, such as the gentleman who presently occupies the White House, can see the event for what truly was, a triumph of the heroic forces of light over the unredeemable forces of darkness. Yes, our gallant battle-tested president stands for everything that is good about America. He is a great idealist, a great humanitarian, and great peacemaker, a veritable deity of truth and justice. And the good doctor, I mean General Wood, is his angel of salvation. Oh, I might add that I was especially pleased to see that the Admiral General Wood has been elevated by President Roosevelt to Chief of Staff of the United States Army. Now General Wood can apply his military genius to a wider field.
How many Filipinos died in the war against the United States?
Nobody is sure. Including the civilians, somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000. The United States government kind of fell down on the job when it came to the business of tabulating victims.
So, we won the war.
That is a fact. We fought shoulder to shoulder with the Filipinos against the Spanish, proclaiming that our land and naval forces came to give them their freedom. We fooled them, used them, until we needed them no longer, and then derided the sucked orange and threw it away. Naturally, our glorious victory over the Filipinos catapulted the United States into the first rank of civilizing nations, and I would not be surprised if our effort in the Philippines will serve as a model in the future for similar charitable exercises by the United States. By the way, I have proposed a new flag for this American province in the Pacific.
Really? What does it look like?
Our usual American flag, but with the white stripes painted black and the stars replaced by the skull and crossbones.
Don't you think that's a bit harsh, Mr. Twain?
On the contrary, I think it captures the spirit of our Philippine enterprise quite well. The Filipinos were a weak and friendless people who turned to us for help in fighting European tyranny. And what did we do? We stabbed them in the back. After they fought for and won their freedom, we stamped out their just, intelligent, and well-ordered republic. Yes, we robbed a trusting friend of his land and liberty. How did we use our brave young boys and the sacred flag they bore? We ordered them to shoulder a discredited musket and do a bandit's work. Yes, yes, bandit's work under our American flag. Sir, we have debauched America's honor and blackened her face before the world. I submit that my proposed flag is entirely in keeping with the spirit and substance of our actions.
Then what would you have the United States do?
If we are to send American boys abroad to fight, it should not be to play the European empire game. No, sir. This American flag is not to be borne into battle to acquire land or money or dominion. That is not what this republic, born in rebellion against European empire, is about. There is something worth pursuing which is more worthy of our tears and blood than filthy lucre. It is the spectacle of a nation of persecuted slaves set free by our hand, the hand of a proud people who will not brook tyrants, who value freedom more than property, more than life itself.
Should we just leave the Philippines?
Of course we should, and as soon as possible. If this war in the Philippines had been played according to the American rules, Admiral Dewey would have sailed away from Manila as soon as he had destroyed the Spanish fleet. And when he left, he should have put up a sign warning covetous powers that any attempt to interfere with the emancipated patriots of the Philippines would be regarded as a distinctly unfriendly act towards the United States.
What would happen to the Filipinos if we left?
I believe they would manage quite well on their own. In short order, they would have starved out the small Spanish garrison in Manila and sent those Spanish boys back home to a happy reunion with their families. Then the Filipinos would have set up their own independent republic according to their own ideas of fairness and justice. And I certainly don't believe we have any monopoly on those virtues. Mr. McDermott Rowe, may I prevail on you for a small favor?
Yes.
My cigar seems to have extinguished in the course of my extended speechifying. Could you possibly...
Of course.
I am much obliged. Please continue.
What did you do personally during the Philippine-American War?
Have you ever heard of a group of folks call themselves the Anti-Imperialist League?
No.
Formed in Boston in 1898, chapters spread throughout the country in no time. I penned a few essays on their behalf, which they distributed by the thousands all over the country. I was, in fact, honored to be asked to serve as vice president of the League's chapter in the great city of New York. I am proud to say that I served in that position from 1901 to 1910. See, I was a pretty big deal at that time, if I do say so myself. What with Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer as my particular associates, people had gotten to know Mark Twain pretty well. So when I opened up, a lot of folks, including those in high places, took notice.
What kind of people joined the Anti-Imperialist League?
A bunch of pudding heads like me who got the notion that we were a republic and not an empire. I probably don't need to remind your audience that we started out as a colony. Didn't like it much, so we changed our situation. Kicked the British out and set up our own operation, just like the Filipinos did to the Spanish. only it didn't work out so well for them. We in the League happen to think that the U.S. Constitution is a pretty good document. Government by the people. Well, empire goes totally against it. It imposes on others the very thing that we fought wars to end. In short, imperialism is un-American.
Did many people join the movement?
The League was a very big draw. You have to remember that back then, empire wasn't a done deal. There were many people throughout the country that simply couldn't swallow the idea of the United States going into the colony business.
I assume they were mainly Democrats.
Oh, no. Our League attracted folks of all stripes. I, for one, am with the Republicans on the money question. We need a gold standard. I believe that William Jennings Bryan and the Democrats are greatly misguided in placing their faith in silver. And it wasn't just the rank and file that joined the Anti-Imperialist League. There were a lot of big shots, too.
Who, for example?
Well, you have the usual suspects, intellectuals. People like Edgar Lee Masters, Ambrose Bierce, and William Dean Howells. But apart from the big brains, we also had some political heavyweights. One was a former president of the United States, Grover Cleveland.
But I assume big business was for empire.
Not necessarily so. We had important friends in that crowd, too. I'm sure you've heard of Andrew Carnegie. He made a fair mark for himself in the steel business.
Then why can't the people put a stop to the empire?
The people, indeed. They're supposed to run this republic from A to Z, but it didn't work out that way. The big money boys and their starched shirt hirelings got hold of this republic, and they're not about to let go. I'm afraid that our republic has been stolen before our eyes by manipulators who have no principle but profit.
Why do people go along with it?
These people in charge know how to sell, whether it's soap, patent medicines, or wars. They just invent a catchy slogan and keep repeating it. And when you listen to their tune all day long, you may start singing it too. And if you don't go along, you're in trouble, brother. They might even call you a traitor, and you sure don't want to be painted with that particular brush.
But, Mr. Twain, we still have elections.
Yes, indeed, we have elections. Every 4 years we have a chance to choose a president amidst a great deal of ballyhoo. But I must say we are not generally given much of a choice. Why take the recent election, the one in 1900? I don't think either McKinley or Bryan had much to offer this country, so I took a pass. Now, don't get me wrong. Elections are a great thing, the lifeblood of a democracy. And there is no greater admirer of that form of government than the person before you right now. But elections are not what they seem to be. You see, the boys with the big money know how to maneuver, to twist the process, so that we, the people, think we're getting a change. But all the time they're calling the shots. Money rules. So it's farewell to our old friend democracy, and hello to an entirely new animal. He's a beast that goes by the name of plutocracy. Big money will have its way in all the great matters of state, especially as concerns questions of war. The people may not want war on a Monday, but by Thursday, Friday at the latest, they'll have the people whooping and hollering for a big fight, willing to send their young sons to kill and be killed in some foreign country they probably can't even locate on a map.
So we go to war.
You bet. We go to war beating up countries less than half our size, all the time proclaiming that we're doing it for their own good.
What happens when the war is a disaster?
Sound the alarm, but be forewarned. They'll say you're unpatriotic or worse. But who are the real patriots? The ones who lead this nation down the road of war and empire, or those that fight to protect its promise of liberty?
Did you encounter a lot of personal criticism?
Oh, sure. There were many so-called patriots who rushed to point out my lack of qualifications for anti-imperialist job. They say, Twain's just a crackpot humorist. What right does he have to question our leaders? Well, that's an easy one. I'm a citizen in a republic, and I have every right to point out who the real jokers are. But the notices weren't all bad. I got a nice note from a paper in Massachusetts, the Springfield Republican, I think it was. They said, quote, Mark Twain has become the most influential anti-imperialist and the most dreaded critic of the sacrosanct person in the White House that the country contains. Mr. President, I invite you to put that in your pipe and smoke it.
So you keep on fighting?
You have to. Sometimes I think there must be two Americas, one that sets the captive free and one that takes a once captive person's freedom away from him.
In the end, which side wins?
I must confess, I don't see a rosy future. I thought my country was special, different from Europe. I thought those boys at Valley Forge kept at it to make a free and independent country, not to make an empire. But it appears that those boys and the rest of us have been taken for a ride. The wars of empire, for dominion, for wealth, they are tragedy for the people we subjugate. But these objects of our greed, unfortunate though they may be, are not the only victims of the lust for empire. No, something else, something of great value that belongs to you, to me, to all the people, is placed in peril when we go down the path of empire.
What is that, Mr. Twain?
Our liberty, my good man. Our very liberty will not survive the mindless pursuit of empire. We cannot enslave others and remain free ourselves. The contradiction will not stand. So we play the empire game, just like the great powers before us. We crush the helpless abroad and take their land and treasure, take their freedom. Well, that game can be played anywhere, anywhere, including here in these United States. And someday soon, we'll find that our liberties are something we can only read about in the history books. That is, if we are permitted to read history books by our new homegrown masters. On that day, we will have a government, not of the people, but of money. It is not a place in which I wish to live.
Do you have any final words for our listening audience, Mr. Twain?
Prove me wrong, young man. Prove me wrong.
Thank you very much, Mr. Twain. We've been speaking with author Mark Twain about his views on American imperialism. This is History Counts, and I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. I'll be right back.
In 1905, Harper & Brothers, Mark Twain's exclusive publisher, blocked publication of some of his anti-imperialist writings, including his famous anti-war essay, The War Prayer, as unsuitable for the Harper's Magazine. In view of this problem, Twain himself declined to submit many of his strongest anti-imperialist and anti-plutocratic writings to the publisher, instead directing that they should be published after his death. Twain died in 1910, but despite his wishes, his literary executors continued to suppress many of his writings. They viewed Mark Twain as a property and did not wish anything to be published by him or about him which might depreciate the value of that property. Twain's official biographer, Albert Bigelow Paine, did not even mention that Mark Twain was an officer of the Anti-Imperialist League. As the years passed, Mark Twain's reputation as a great writer of fiction continued to grow, but his historically important role as one of America's great anti-imperialists faded. When Mark Twain was a leader of the anti-imperialist movement at the turn of the century, he and others argued vehemently that the United States could not remain a republic and its citizens could not remain free if the nation were to go down the road of global empire. That same argument is still heard in America today from every part of the political spectrum. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. History Counts is engineered by David Schwartz. In today's program, Mark Twain was portrayed by Carl White. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.